Greek mythology has a story of a handsome youth who loved no one until one day he saw his own reflection in the water and fell deeply in love with it. He was so lovesick for himself that he eventually wasted away and died. And he was turned into the flower that bears his name, Narcissus. Naturally, we abhor narcissism, which is infatuation with oneself. And we carefully seek to avoid it. However, certain scriptures, such as today's text passage, actually condone self-love. In fact, the Apostle Paul uses a husband's love for his own body and its needs as an illustration of how a husband must love his own wife. Well, last week we considered the subject of a husband's love for his wife in verses 25 to 27. And we saw in verse 25 that it must be self-sacrificing and it involves death. Not necessarily physical death for your wife, but it always involves a dying to self. Secondly, in verses 26 and 27, Paul describes a husband's love for his wife by what I called its sanctifying effects. Christ's love for his church has a cleansing and sanctifying effect on her, and so should a husband's love for his bride have sanctifying effects on her to prepare her for heaven. This morning, in verses 28 and following, Paul continues the subject of a husband's love for his wife by describing how he must love her, which perhaps somewhat surprisingly is just as he loves himself. This time a husband's love is not described in terms of self-sacrifice or sanctifying efforts, but rather by nourishing and cherishing his wife in the same manner he would care for and provide for his own body. And to help us grasp the depth of this self-care and self-love that Paul says that husbands must have for their wives, he drills down, think of it this way, he drills down three levels deep into three verses to help us see how husbands must love their wives, which is the theme of our text passage this morning. The first level he drills down to is in verse 28. And if you're making an outline, the first point that Paul makes is this, that a husband must love his wife in the same manner that he loves himself. I'll repeat it. A husband must love his wife in the same manner that he loves himself. Look at verse 28 again with me. It says, "So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself." Now, I think we have to stretch a little to be able to comprehend how profound a saying this really is. Paul gives a command to husbands to love their own wives as their own bodies, right? I mean, that's what he says. He says that a husband must love and care for his wife just as he loves and cares for his own body. And then Paul makes this incredible statement at the end of this verse. He who loves his wife loves himself. You see that? But note that Paul isn't saying love your wife as much as you love yourself. No, on the contrary, he's saying something very different than that. He is saying that to love your wife is actually to love your own body because she is your own body. And therefore, Paul can say to husbands, he who loves his wife loves himself. Charles Hodge wrote this. He said, "If, as the scriptures teach, husband and wife are one, then he who loves his wife loves himself, for she is himself. End quote. So this is a radical command, isn't it? It's a radical command, and it's important for us to grasp this, because husbands are prone, I think, to do bad things to their wife sometimes. You know, they're prone to retaliate when their wives treat them poorly, to get back at them, to wound them in return for wounds that they've received from them. And sometimes the husband ignores his wife, which is a cruel form of abuse. Or perhaps he explodes in anger towards her. But Paul reminds Christian husbands of something very important here. Namely, listen, that when you hurt your wife, you are hurting your own body. Because she is you. You got that? She is you. Now, I'm not saying this means that in marriage the distinct personalities of husband and wife are eliminated, and that you're somehow assimilated into one another so that there's no me and you in your relationship. That's not what the apostle is saying here. But in a very real sense, listen, in a very real sense, he is saying, based on what Moses taught in Genesis chapter 2, that your wife is your own body. In fact, in verse 31, Paul quotes Genesis 2. Did you notice that? And his point there is that when marriage occurs and when a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife, something mysterious happens, right? The two become one flesh. They become one body. So when a husband loves his wife, whom does he love? He loves his own flesh. He loves his own body. Paul is teaching that in some mysterious way, one that can't be fully described, there is a continuation of this oneness that began with Adam and Eve. Do you remember where Eve came from? I mean, Adam was a dirt guy, right? Adam came from the dirt. He came from the dirt. But the woman came out of the man, out of his side. She was literally a part of him. And Paul says that in some mysterious way, this oneness continues to exist in the relationship between a husband and a wife. So husbands, if you're tempted to retaliate against your wife, then realize that you are simply injuring yourself. But when you love her and nourish her and cherish her, then you love yourself, because she is you. I don't know how I can say that any better or more accurately than that. When you love her, you are loving your own body, because in marriage, a husband and a wife have a one-flesh relationship. And therefore, Paul's command to husbands is to love your wife as your own body, because in fact and in reality, he who loves his wife loves himself. This is the first thing Paul wants us to grasp and understand. The relationship that God has established, this one flesh relationship that he has established between husband and wife, is such that as you love your wife, you love yourself. So a husband must love his wife in the same manner that he loves himself. However, one level down isn't deep enough to explain how husbands must love their wives. So Paul gets out the drill and he drills down to a second level in verse 29. And the second point, if you're taking an outline, is this: a husband must love his wife with the same tender care that Christ loves his church. I'll repeat it. A husband must love his wife with the same tender care that Christ loves his church. Verse 29, look at it with me. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. Paul here answers the question, how? How is a husband supposed to practically love his wife as his own body? And the answer is by nourishing and cherishing her with the same tender care with which Christ loves his church. That word nourish, by the way, in the Greek, ektrepko, means to nurture. And the word cherish is the Greek word thalpo, which means to keep warm. So think of it as a warm nurturing. And Paul's only other use of that verb is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 7, where in very powerful imagery, he speaks of his love for the Thessalonians when he wrote, and he said, "We proved to be gentle among you as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children." Both words, cherish and nourish, express the idea of tenderness. And they demonstrate the tender nurture and care that a man provides for the needs and comfort of his own body, and also demonstrates the tender care that husbands are to provide for the needs and comforts of his wife. Yesterday, I read a story that illustrates a husband's tenderness toward his wife. I'll share it with you this morning. In post-World War II London, at a formal banquet attended by many dignitaries, including the famous Winston Churchill, a question was posed to all of these people, namely, that if you could not be who you are, then who would you like to be? If you could not be who you are, then who would you like to be? So around the room, everyone was answering the question until finally it was Churchill's turn. And rising up from his chair, seated next to his beloved wife, Clemmy, he replied, "If I could not be who I am, then I would most like to be," and here he paused to tenderly take his wife's hand, and then said, "Lady Churchill's second husband." Oh, the old boy really scored some points that night, didn't he? Boy, I'll tell you. Hey, what a beautiful illustration of demonstrating tenderness towards one's wife. Now, there's something else that Paul is telling husbands here about how they must love their wives. You notice again the expression in verse 29, "For no one ever hated his own flesh." Did you see that? "For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it." That describes a natural kind of inbred instinct. No one by nature instinctively hates his own flesh, Paul says. But on the contrary, he nourishes and he cherishes it. No one has to teach a man that. He instinctively knows how to do it, right? It happens automatically, reflexively, and instinctively. It's like a mother tenderly caring for her infant child. It's automatic. So to husbands, Paul says, cultivate that instinct in the provision and care of your wife, so that it becomes second nature that you're going to love her that way, with that same kind of tender care. That instinct that drives you to provide for your own needs and comfort, transfer that into caring for your wife so that it becomes an automatic response to give yourself to her in that way. Because a husband must love his wife with the same tender care that Christ loves his church. Now let's apply this to the husbands. The application is this. A husband's love for his wife should always be expressed with sensitivity and tenderness. I'll repeat it. A husband's love for his wife should always be expressed with sensitivity and tenderness. Perhaps we should pause here and recognize that only God's grace and the gospel can produce that ability in a husband, right? I mean, that just doesn't come naturally for any of us men, right? Most of us men are pretty good at being kind of the opposite. You know, we're kind of good at being rough and harsh and insensitive. Or maybe that's just me. I don't know. Any of you men like that? You know, I mean, men can kind of tend to be that way. It comes naturally to them. They're not really of the tender variety, usually. But tenderly loving and caring for wives as Christ cares for His church, that requires a work of grace. That requires a miracle, I would say, in the heart of a man. And that's what the gospel produces in a man's life. It changes him, right? From the inside out. It transforms him into someone new. It even enables him to love his wife and to nourish and cherish her even as the Lord does the church. And that's a gracious, miraculous thing, isn't it? The good news of the gospel is that God can turn harsh, insensitive men into husbands that tenderly care for their wives. Wow. And that's why Paul can assert that a husband must love his wife with the same tender care that Christ loves His church. Well, finally, Paul takes out the drill one more time and he's going to go another level deep. He drills down one more level in his effort to help us grasp the depth of the self-care and self-love that husbands must have for their wives. And the third point that he makes in verses 30 to 32 is this, that a husband must love his wife because God designed marriage to be a picture of the union of Christ and His church. I'll repeat it. A husband must love his wife because God designed marriage to her to be a picture of the union of Jesus Christ and His church. Look at verse 30 to 32. For we are members of His body, Paul says, of His flesh and of His bones. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Paul says that the reason why husbands must love their wives has to do with a oneness and a union that exists between Christ and His church. Did you get that? Paul is telling us here, he's telling husbands, or he's saying that the reason why husbands must love their wives has to do with this oneness and this union that exists between Christ and His bride, the church. And Paul reaches all the way back to the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings, and to the creation account when Eve was created from Adam. And you'll notice the incredible similarity of verses 30 and 31 to what Moses records in Genesis chapter 2, which we read earlier, and I'll now quote it again, where he said, "And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones." Look at your text. "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh." There is a oneness that husband and wife share together by virtue of their union together as man and wife. From the beginning, marriage was intended by God to picture the oneness and union of Christ and His bride, the church. This is the great mystery of which Paul speaks and writes in verse 32. And it's this mystery that pictures the union of Christ and His church. And it's also Paul's reason. Listen, it's also Paul's reason why husbands must love their wives. It's because they are one flesh. All the way through this passage, Paul draws a parallel between Christ and His bride, the church, and husbands and their wives. And he reasons that just as Christ and His body, the church, are one, so too are husbands and wives one. Think of it this way. Beneath the union of a husband and wife in marriage is a deeper union between Christ and His bride, the church. And Paul reasons that a husband must love his wife because God designed marriage to be a picture, a portrayal of this blessed union. Now, I see an application here related to the Lord's Supper, since we're about to partake of that this morning. We celebrate our spiritual union together as members of Christ's body every time we come together and partake of this table. When the Corinthians came together for the Lord's Supper, they were to what? They were to discern and to recognize the Lord's body, to consider the union created, as it were, between Christ and His people, and perceive that in some mysterious way they were members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones. And of course, we're to do the same thing every time we gather around this table. Though Christ is now in heaven in His human body, and though He sits at the right hand of God the Father Almighty, fully human and fully divine, yet in some mysterious way, listen, in some mysterious way, we are His body, members of His flesh and bones. That's the nature of the union and communion we share together with Christ. And Paul is saying to husbands that this deep reality of the union which we enjoy with God as His people and as members of His body is to control the way we love and care for our wives. And when we nourish and cherish them as our own bodies, we portray a visible witness to the world concerning the way Christ nourishes and cherishes His church. Isn't that incredible? I mean, think of that. That is just awesome. It's off the scale. And again, I think there's an application here, especially for those who are married, when you, and particularly husbands, when you live out New Testament commands for how you're supposed to love and care for one another, then you're being a witness to the world of this mystery of Christ's union with His people. It's a reminder that marriage is about something bigger than just two people in love and in a relationship to each other. And it's precisely the absence of that realization among Christians today that marriage is about something bigger than them that has so terribly undermined and undervalued marriage, even among believers. If Christians, listen, if Christians understood that there's something greater at stake than their present temporary happiness, or their financial stability, or the well-being of their children in a marriage, if Christians could grasp that there's something more important than those things, namely a witness to the reality of Christ's love for His church, then perhaps there would be fewer problems and conflicts in relationships between husbands and wives. Perhaps there would be a stronger union, unity, and oneness in marriage if husbands understood that love for their bride is the most powerful evangelistic witness to an unbelieving world. You can almost hear the conversations that go on. Look how he treats his wife. He loves her as he loves himself. He cherishes her and treats her with such tender care. Have you seen how that man loves his wife? When a husband loves his wife that way, it's a witness to the world. It's a picture of Christ's glorious union with His bride, the church. And doors of opportunity and witness will swing open when the unconverted see and marvel at how husbands love their wives as the Lord does His church. Amen. Amen. Well, let's move right on to the Lord's Supper. This morning we're considering how husbands must love their wives. And all throughout this passage, we've seen what this love looks like. It is self-love, Paul says, that loves a wife in the same manner that a husband loves himself. It's a love that tenderly cares for her as Christ cares for His church, nourishing and cherishing her, just as the Lord does the church. And it's a love motivated by the realization that a husband's love for his wife is a picture of Christ's love for His bride, the church. This is how a husband must love his bride, just like Christ loved His. This is yesterday. I read this quote in a book written by Mark Chansky. And the article was How Christ Loved His Bride, the Church. I thought I would read it to you as something fitting to prepare our hearts as we come to this table. He said, "For His bride, He left heaven's glory. For His bride, He cried in Bethlehem's manger and worked in Nazareth's workshop. For His bride, He was numbered with the transgressors in His baptism. For His bride, He endured near starvation and satanic temptation in the wilderness. For His bride, He absorbed years of public ministry abuse by a wicked and adulterous generation. For His bride, He had no place to lay His head. For His bride, He marched fearlessly towards the Jerusalem slaughterhouse. For His bride, He broke the bread in the upper room. For His bride, He was drenched in blood-like sweat. For His bride, He said, 'Not my will, but thine be done.' For His bride, He handed Himself over to a kangaroo court. For His bride, He was repeatedly spat upon and struck in the head. For His bride, He stood barebacked at a pillar, absorbing scourge after scourge. For His bride, He was mocked while holding a reed scepter. For His bride, He carried and collapsed under the cross beam. For His bride, He was stripped naked. For His bride, He accepted the spikes into His hands and feet. For His bride, He was lifted up between heaven and earth as an accursed spectacle. For His bride, He hung His head before wagging scoffers. For His bride, He gasped for breath and cried out, 'My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?' And for His bride, He said, 'It is finished.' And He died."